Okay, let's go ahead and move into Romans. What I'm going to be talking about tonight, I have written at a scholarly level, so I have an article, and so if any of you would like to read that article, I can send you a link to it, and that's it. If just go ahead and email me, and then I'll send you the link.
Do people know your email address?
I'm at Langprof. That's an abbreviation for language professor, even though I'm no longer, as of a couple weeks ago, I'm no longer a professor. That was my choice. I'm getting too old for that sort of stuff. But anyway... Langprof, which is an abbreviation for language professor, so langprof@gmail.com. And I'll send you a link to the article that I wrote. It goes into more depth than the introduction to this commentary, which I wrote the introduction to the book of Romans in the commentary by Zane Hodges. And so what I'm talking about tonight derives out of that. About 6 months before Zane Hodges died, I asked him a question about his work in preparing for this commentary. I asked him, what book did he find, or what did he encounter in his research on the book of Romans that affected him the most? There was not a moment's pause. He said, Jewett on Romans because of his work on the tenement church. And so I will be summarizing issues related to that. He did not live long enough to write the introduction to his commentary, but since I had had that conversation with Zane Hodges, I knew that when I was doing my introduction that I needed to bring those issues out, so I wrote the article, and I also wrote the introduction that will cover the issues we're talking about tonight. Okay. Now, I'm sure that there are a few Trekkies. Let's see. Hit my button and it's not Steve.
Yeah,
what?
Your mouse is on
it's
the
over
screen.
Here.
Yeah.
It's Windows and F5 or what is it, P to get the double?
Windows and P.
Yeah, to get
the
double.
Yeah, to hit the window number and P, I think.
Right now, extended. So.
Well, I am on extend.
You don't want to be in duplicate.
Dual.
Okay.
Yeah, dual or something.
That's duplicate.
It is
duplicate, yeah.
But I don't have my key. Ah, there we go. It now works. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm sure we have some Trekkie fans here. But you know, the saying that was always characteristic, that was controlling of much of what they did, was to boldly go where no man has gone before. Now, the Apostle Paul actually had statements similar to that, and we'll explore that a little bit, but yeah, it's a very interesting thing to see what develops if someone discovers that they have something, a real contribution that they can make to people's lives. And this young man, tomorrow will be his birthday, he'll be 69 years old. His mother couldn't read. He grew up in a very disadvantaged situation. He was in trouble at school, and his mother came up with a brilliant idea. she assigned every day for this young man and his brother to read. They had to go to the library, they had to go and check out a book and write a report on it and tell her about the book that they read. Now, she wasn't able to read, but she insisted that her boys would do this. Well, later on, this man became very famous. Ben Carson. And when you see what he accomplished, you know, when he was able to separate Siamese twins that shared a brain, he was a brain surgeon, that's definitely going boldly where no man has gone before. And the accomplishments that he had in his life are just absolutely amazing. When you think about the Apostle Paul, Paul started out as an opponent to the church. He was going and arresting people so that they could be tried and they could be put to death. And then the Lord got a hold of him. And there was nothing that was going to hold him back from going and telling people who had not heard about Jesus before. Well, Rome, as we're going to see, was a church that was already in existence. He's not planting it, but Paul is going to tell us that his goal was to name the name of Christ where Christ was not named before. He wanted to go and to minister where other apostles had not been. In Acts 19:21, Paul purposed, when he had passed through Macedonia, that's northern Greece, that's where my curved arrow starts, the red one, that's northern Greece, and Achaia, that's southern Greece, to go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. So, Paul has as an objective to go through Greece, get back to Jerusalem, and then his goal is to go to Rome. He never imagined that he would do so as a prisoner of the Romans. But his objective was to get there because there had not yet been any of the apostles there. Essentially, the rest of the apostles seem to have been in Asia. There isn't evidence of any of them having preceded Paul to get to Europe or even further west in Europe. But you know, Paul could have plans. He wrote the book of Romans in the year 56, and he said, my flights have been canceled more often than you can think. Now, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that I have often planned to come to you, but was hindered until now, that I might have some fruit among you also, just as among the other Gentiles. And so, like Star Trek, he is wanting to go where others had not gone, but in his case, to name the name of Christ. And he's wanting Rome to become quite a missionary base. He speaks eloquently in chapter 1 of their faith that is proclaimed throughout the world, but he wants to strengthen them that the message can go out because, as we know, all roads lead to Rome. Now, Paul has short and long-term goals. In chapter 15, verse 20, in the book of Romans, we're told that Paul aimed to preach the gospel where Christ was not named. Notice he said, and so I have made it my aim to preach the gospel, not where Christ was named, lest I should build on another man's foundation. Now, unfortunately, people have thought that this is a short-term goal, and they've thought that it's saying, oh, I want to go to Rome because Rome doesn't have any believers. No, it has a church, and we're going to see it was a thriving church. His long-term goal is to go where no one else has gone. Now, he said that that aim has hindered him from coming to Rome until now. Notice how he says in verse 22, "For this reason, I also have been much hindered from coming to you." Verse 23, "But now, no longer having a place in these parts, and having great desire these many years to come to you." He's saying, there really isn't so much of a reason for me to stay here in Greece, in southern Greece. He was at Corinth at the time that he wrote the letter. Actually, I'll show you how we know he was at Corinth when he wrote Romans. Let's take a minor digression and go to Romans 16:1. "I commend to you Phoebe, our sister, who is a servant of the church in Cenchrea." Cenchrea is 7 miles from Corinth. And so Phoebe is the one who's going to carry the letter of Romans to the city of Rome. And so he gives her the letter for her to take. And so that's what he's referring to when he says in verse 23, he no longer has a place in these parts. He's saying, my ministry here, I've been in and around Corinth for 3 years. It's drawing to a close. It's time for me to move on. Well, then in verse 24, he says he wants to go to Spain. That is where he's talking about a long-term goal, but his short-term goal is to stop in Rome. Notice verse 24 of Romans 15. "Whenever I journey to Spain, I shall come to you, for I hope to see you on my journey and be helped on my way there by you, if first I may enjoy your company for a while." So we need to recognize his short-term goal was to get to Rome. His long-term goal was to get to Spain because there wasn't a church community there. Spain was a place where Christ had not been named by others. In particular, he had not been named by any apostles. And so he's not saying Rome has no believers. But he's saying my long-term goal is to get to Spain where there are no believers. My short-term goal, he's willing to go short-term where other apostles are or have been. But long-term goal is for him to get to Spain. We need to cover a few more details in Romans chapter 1 that will help us understand some things here that Paul is addressing believers. Notice what he says in Romans 1:7. "To all who are in Rome, beloved of God, called saints." Now, your Bible may have the words "to be" in between "called" and "saints." If you understand that "to be," which was added, it's not in the Greek, if you understand it as they were called and they are saints, that's fine. But what he's saying here is they are called saints. They are believers. Let's see some further evidence of that. Look at verse 8. "First, I thank my God through Jesus Christ for y'all, that your faith is spoken of throughout the whole world." He's saying he's writing to believers. He's not writing to unbelievers, even though that commonly is how people portray, misconstrue the book of Romans. He's writing to believers. And so, this, by the way, this slide is showing a model of the city of Rome as it may have been laid out in the first century, and that's including buildings that were built during the first century, although some of the buildings that are here, like the Colosseum near the center at the top, were built after Paul wrote Romans. This at least gives an idea of what the city of Rome might have looked like. But notice he's writing to people who are believers. Now, why is it that Paul wants to go to Rome? Well, all roads lead to Rome. That was true then, and it's true now, and it's interesting how in the city of Rome, everything converges upon the old center of the city. Notice that pattern of roads leading in. And so all roads do lead to Rome. I mean, you can, if you go in the right direction on any of these roads, you end up in Rome. And the Roman roads were built so well that we find Roman roads that are still in existence that have the ruts from the wagon wheels that went over them. Don't get me into a digression about why the railroad gauge on our trains is 4 feet, 8.5 inches. Okay, I'll digress. The question becomes, the gauge on the wagons in Rome were 4 feet, 8.5 inches. Why is that the gauge of American railroads? Well, the first railroad cars were built by wagon makers, and so they used their same jigs. They made the wagons the same width as they did for the their wagons. They did the same thing for the railroad cars. But then the question becomes, why did they do that? Well, that was the gauge that the Romans used. Well, why did the Romans have 4 foot, 8.5 inch gauge? That is related to the width of a team of horses. If you have a team of horses, you've got all of your harness, you've got all everything there so they can pull, but the width of the horses came out that if you built a wagon with a 4 foot, 8.5 inch gauge, the wagons ended up being approximately the same width as the team of horses. It is inefficient to build roads that would be really wide. If you had wide wagons, then you just have to have the roads being wider for two wagons to be able to pass. So they basically said it that the width of two horses while they were harnessed together would be how wide they wanted the wagons to be. And so that ended up making the gauge, and that's transmitted all the way down to our railroads. Okay, enough of a digression.
I didn't know that.
That's cool. Over 9 feet because they're wide enough for two carts to go each direction.
Right. Now, if you're in a town, they'll be wider because they would have people parking to unload. So if you go through the center of a city where they have all the commerce, there the roads end up being wider. But when you're out in the country, the roads, Roman roads, have a uniform width. And it's all related to this issue. But in addition to all roads leading to Rome, all roads lead from Rome. Paul looks at Rome as being a wonderful base from which the message can go out. People would go into Rome, but roads generally lead in two directions. So Paul is looking strategically at wanting this place to succeed so that the message can get out. Okay, now what we have to do is look at a little bit of history in the second section of the notes. The cross and Pentecost, when the church began, is in the year 33. We have an important edict by the Emperor Claudius in the year 49. Paul wrote the book of Romans in the winter of 56-57. And then 3 years later, Paul was jailed in Rome, and Paul was freed from jail in Rome in 62, And then there is the great fire of Rome in the year 64. So we have 24 years of Christianity prior to Paul writing this book, 33 to 57, and we have 7 years between the writing of the book and the fire in Rome. So let's look at these features. Okay, actually we'll look at it here through the notes, and I'll amplify on that. I thought I had set up a couple of notes there, but Acts chapter 2 verse 10 mentions that there were visitors at the Feast of Pentecost from Rome, among other places, that were present at Pentecost, and some of them became believers. We assume that they went back to Rome carrying the message of Christianity, so we would assume that there was a church community that started in Rome in the year 33. But we don't then see any further contact mentioning Rome within the New Testament until Paul writes the book of Romans. But then, if we turn to Acts chapter 18, we'll look at this, what's related to this edict of Claudius, the emperor. Acts 18, and we'll start at verse 1. After these things, Paul departed from Athens and went to Corinth. Now he found a certain Jew named Aquila, born in Pontus, that's in Turkey, who had recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews, and more specifically, all the Jewish Christians in the synagogues, the leaders in particular, to depart from Rome, and he came to them. So in other words, Priscilla and Aquila had been in Rome, and they were ministering there. It becomes evident that they were people that were involved in ministry, but they were evicted. The Claudian Edict was an effort to resolve a problem that had happened within the Jewish community in Rome. Specifically, the Roman sources tell us that there were controversies in the synagogues over a certain Christus, Christ. That there were some Jews who were saying that Christ was to be worshipped, and others were saying, no, he's false. And so there was turmoil, there was a lot of problems that were happening within the synagogues, and the emperor Claudius said, let's get the troublemakers out of here, they all have to leave the city of Rome. And so Priscilla and Aquila were expelled from the city of Rome, and they ended up in Corinth. Paul came to Corinth, and he met them. Now, it also tells us that they were tent makers just as Paul was a tent maker. Okay, then let's go to winter of AD 56-57. Paul wrote Romans. He was in Corinth, as we see in 1 Corinthians 16:1. And Paul indicated, as we've seen, that he had never been to Rome. He's made it his goal to get to Rome. He's never been there before. In late February of the year 60, Paul's ship arrived in Italy, and he was imprisoned in Rome for a little over 2 years. We find this in the book of Acts. In March of AD 62 is when Paul was released from prison. And then July 19th through the 27th of the year 64 is the great fire in Rome. And Nero blamed Christians for the fire, because people were blaming Nero for the fire. And so he in turn shifted blame to the Christians. So that fire is going to be very important for us to understand the book of Romans, even though Romans was written 7 years before the fire. We're going to learn things as we put together a historical tapestry, and that fire, 7 years after Paul wrote, is going to end up giving us some interesting clues about the book of Romans. So the next question, big or little? Was the church at Rome a little tiny group, or was it large? Now most people, let's look at Romans 16. You'll notice in Romans 16 that we have a lot of people named. Starting in verse 3, greet Prisca and Aquila. I know your Bible reads Priscilla. My Greek text reads Prisca. That was her Roman name. Priscilla was a nickname. And in Latin quarters, they were really, really concerned about how noble your birth was. And she had a higher birth than her husband. So Paul made sure to list her first, and he listed her by her official name, Prisca. Every other occurrence, whether written by Luke or whether written by Paul, says Aquila and Priscilla. But Paul is paying attention to the social norms in Rome, and he gave her her formal name, and he put her first because her birth was higher than her husband's birth. And so, but after that, it's Greek, 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 Greek. Look at the text and you see how many times it says Greek? Going between there and verse 15, it shows up a bunch of times. I'll save you a little time. Here are all the names of the people that Paul is greeting. And most people have said, oh, Paul's writing to a little church of 20-some-odd people. And most of the literature treats it as though that's the case. Robert Jewett, in arguing on the tenement church, said, no, that's not right. It's a big church. And we'll have to look at the evidence and put it together, so that's what we're going to do. Question now in the book of Romans, though, is if he's writing to a little group that's hardly gone anywhere, he might need to clarify the gospel as far as how to receive eternal life. But as we've argued, as Steve was arguing as he was presenting an overview of Romans, this is a book about how believers can avoid God's wrath and become highly rewardable by walking by the Spirit, pleasing God. Paul has an ambitious aim, but his aim in this book is not evangelistic. His aim is to cause these believers to become rewardable. Most people presuppose that the book of Romans is an elementary book either written to new believers or to unbelievers. But that's not the case at all. There's often what's called the Roman road that people have because of their misconstrual of the book of Romans. And they think that this is a book presenting how to get eternal life. And as we saw in Romans chapter 10, the believe and confess, the confessing has nothing to do with getting eternal life. It's talking about believers calling on the name of the Lord, believers praying so that they can be delivered. The salvation is talking about deliverance for believers who are walking by the Spirit. But Roman road is an approach that's been taken because people have a complete misunderstanding of the whole book. Alternate view. Roman Christianity, that is, Christianity in the city of Rome, was not tiny. They were not brand new believers. They weren't neophytes. And rewardability was the big issue. Okay, now let's move forward 7 years to the fire in the year 64. The fire gives us some very, very interesting clues. Now this place here in the foreground is called the Circus Maximus. And they used to do all kinds of things. They had chariot races. They had all kinds of things. This was a very special place. It was in this neighborhood right here where the fire in Rome got its start. So the Circus Maximus is something that can be seen to this day, but that's going to be where the fire started. And you'll notice that I have the arrow pointing, and it's pointing to the Circus Maximus. And then I have marked out the 14 districts within the city of Rome that existed during the first century. And so an interesting thing that occurs is that the literature about the fire tells us how many of those districts were affected and tells us about which ones were affected. And basically the area where I put the flames was demolished. People were left homeless, lots of people died, and it was a terrible mess there. And we're going to see later some evidence about how densely packed this was. This city was, for the ancient world, truly huge. It was about 1 million population. City's population was about 1 million. More than 70% of the city was destroyed. Thousands died. Nero blamed Christians. And that's a big, important question. Why did he blame Christians? It doesn't make sense for him to blame Christians if they were a small, stagnant group. They had to be big enough that they were a threat to Nero. They had to be big enough and that people would look at them and say, they're a threat. Because Nero isn't wanting to say, oh, the Christians did it, and everyone say, really? He wants them to say, yeah. You know, just like Hitler, when he blamed the Jews for everything, was it because there were only a couple Jews in Germany? No, it was because there were a lot of Jews, and a lot of people didn't really like the Jews, so that was a way that he could get them stirred up against them. Christianity in 64, 7 years after the book of Romans was written, cannot be a tiny group. So, Nero, we're told, this is a citation from Tacitus Annals, all of Nero's gifts could not persuade the people that the fire was not the result of an order, that is, by Nero. So he fastened the guilt and exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. In communion, we talk about how we're consuming the body, that the bread represents his body, and the juice represents his blood. And so the rumor went around that Christians were cannibals. And so when Christians were hated for being cannibals who didn't worship the Roman emperor. I mean, they were terrible people. So it wasn't hard to get the people stirred up against them. And so when you have people saying, oh, Nero, you gave an order to do this. He says, oh no, it wasn't me, it was those Christians. If there were only a couple Christians, he's not going to be able to stir up everybody against them. Everybody's heard about the Christians because it's a big group. And people have heard bad things about their cannibals, and they don't worship the emperor. Oh, let's see. So, now, persecutors target threats. They don't target someone that's not perceived as a threat. You target someone and say, you know, they're really bad, we have to get after them. So, let's take a new look at how the church at Rome was constituted. We saw in Acts 18 that Paul met Priscilla and Aquila there. But we have some other interesting things that happen in this. Look at verse 5. The second part of verse 5 says, greet my beloved Epaphras, who is the first fruits of Achaia, southern Greece, to Christ. Paul hasn't been to Rome, but we're looking at people that have been outside of Rome. Maybe these are also people like Priscilla and Aquila that were evicted during the Claudian Edict. Notice how he says in verse 6, greet Mary, who labored much for us. That tells us Paul knew Mary. Paul hadn't been to Rome, but Mary had been to somewhere that Paul had been. And then he knows that Andronicus and Junia are fellow Jews, and they're fellow prisoners. Why would they be prisoners? They're Christians, probably actively involved in ministry. And he says that they are of note among the apostles who also were in Christ before me. He says in verse 8 that Amplius is my beloved in the Lord. He knows him. Greet Urbanus, our fellow worker. These are people Paul knows, but Paul hasn't been to Rome. That meant these people have been to where Paul was. Paul has ministered to them. Paul knows them. And Paul is saying, they're on the same page as I am. I would submit that these are people like Priscilla and Aquila who were evicted from Rome during the Claudian Edict. These are not people who sit in a pew. We're looking at people who are active in ministry, whether in a congregational setting or in personal ministry with others. Okay. When I mentioned Priscilla and Aquila, they had left Rome and ended up in Corinth, and we're told that Aquila was from Pontus. That's up in Turkey, and it's marked up there. So we're seeing evidence that Paul is meeting people who haven't always been in Rome. So Paul knew many of these people. We went through that with fellow workers who risked their own necks for my life, and so on and so forth. He knows these people that he's greeting. They do not constitute the whole church, but they are some of the leadership of the church. Now notice, we have 16 uses of greet. What Jewett argued persuasively is that each time he says greet, he's talking about a different local church. Let's look at what he says in verse 3. Greet Prisca and Aquila, my fellow workers in Christ Jesus, who risked their own necks for my life, to whom I not only give thanks, but also all the churches of God. Likewise, implicitly, greet the church that is in their house. They didn't have church buildings with steeples. They were meeting in houses, or in many cases, in tenements.
Okay, so a tenement is a bigger space?
A tenement is a smaller space, but it's an apartment building.
Okay.
And
do you have pictures?
Yes, I have pictures. So we'll... okay. Let's say that those 15 congregations were scattered around Rome like this. We have no idea, except we figure that most of them were in poor areas because there's evidence that some of these were slaves. Where your text reads, greet those of the household of, those were slaves in most cases.
And Jewish slaves. Jewish believer slaves.
Could be any ethnicity. Because Rome, the slaves outnumbered the free-born population. And so they could be of any ethnicity. But a very interesting thing we're going to be seeing, these congregations are ethnically exclusive.
Hey, John, is this where the catacomb, under the ground?
Yeah, they were underground, but that was a little later on.
You know, it's interesting, gentlemen. I was in China. A lot of those house churches were much like this.
Sure.
Because of the oppression that was against them. They had to meet and could meet in more secret. It was difficult for the authorities to catch them.
Yes.
Instead of going to one place. So it makes a lot of sense that
absolutely
with the oppression that they had, that this is exactly what's happening.
Absolutely. Okay, now there are surviving insulae. Insula is the word for these tenement apartment buildings. There are surviving insulae from as early as 300 BC in Ostia. Ostia used to be the port, but it's filled in, so Ostia is no longer on the sea. In Rome, they thought that there were around 45,000 insulae in the first century. What you have is the walls were very thick at the lower stories, and it would gradually get thinner as you went up because thickness was the only way they could support weight. Now, some interesting documents have surfaced. There's a papyrus where someone is giving directions how to get to their eighth floor apartment in an insula. Now, what happened was the higher you went up, the walls got thinner, but the rooms got smaller. Down on the bottom, you would have stores, and the second floor tended to be wealthy people, but you go up, and the further up you go, the poorer you are. And these are some... upper stories of these would be where people would live. And then here's one that's kind of a cutaway, giving an idea of what they were like. The insulae that survive now are only a few stories high because over time, upper stories didn't do so well. But this is how most of the poor people lived. And I mean, they had tiny quarters. If you had the ability for 10 people to meet, I mean, these are really, really, really tiny apartments that people would have been in. But we've got an issue we have to deal with. The Roman historians tell us that Nero killed a huge multitude of Christians in the city of Rome in the year 64. Now, if he kills a huge multitude in 64, that requires that there would have been a substantial Christian community in the city of Rome at the time Paul wrote. Mormons have had one of the most amazing levels of growth for any religious group. I mean, they're always looked at as being really big. It slowed down somewhat for them, but from the years 1960 through 1990, they were growing at 4.5% a year. And for a growth of numbers of people in a movement, that's huge. Well, let's assume that Christianity had a 5% compounded growth. If one assumes a 5% growth rate per year, that's allowing for people dying and having other people replace them. For every 71 Christians in AD 66, there would be 101 in 64. So it, working out as a compound interest factor, it goes from 71 to 101. If you have a huge multitude that Nero put to death, how many Christians didn't he find? And yet he killed a huge multitude. Now, 5% growth rate is a really steep growth rate. This requires that Christianity be a sizable group when Paul wrote the book of Romans. And there is no other way to explain how Nero is able to find and kill a huge number, and yet he didn't get all of them. Because Christianity kept growing, kept growing, and kept growing. And in the year 313, Constantine, the Roman Emperor at that time, was so threatened by Christianity, he said, I guess we might as well join them. And he made it first legal, and secondly, the official state religion. But Paul greets 15 groups of people. He's greeting leaders that he already met in Greece and elsewhere. But would we imagine that those leaders would only meet with one group during a week? I mean, if you have 9 people come over to your apartment on Sunday morning, are you going to say, well, okay, we've had our 9 people get together. That's all the people we can accommodate all week long. We'd expect that they probably would meet a couple more times a week. And Paul only greeted people he knew. He didn't greet people he didn't know. There might be more groups of other people that he didn't know, but Paul greeted people that he knew. It's not hard to imagine there being 1,000 Christians in Rome at the time that Paul wrote the book of Romans. Remember, AD 33, day of Pentecost, is probably when things got rolling. And Paul then is writing to people that he's ministered alongside of, some of whom he calls fellow workers, fellow soldiers, fellow prisoners, and my beloved, and so forth. Those people would have been able to carry an accurate message and minister to people. There's reason to expect that by the time Paul writes this letter, there are a lot of different groups meeting at a lot of different places throughout the city. And so, again, Nero killed a huge crowd in 64. Claudius expelled leaders in 49. Would Claudius have been worried about it if there were only a couple Christians? Why would the emperor get involved in an edict telling the Christian leaders they had to leave? Christianity had probably been fairly sizable by the year 49, the time of Acts 18:1 and 2. Christianity in Rome in 56-57 probably numbered over 1,000. Its numbers were even higher in 64. It was huge in 313 under the Emperor Constantine. Now, how did Christianity grow? How did it have this type of growth? Was it because Billy Graham came to town? Well, just like in China, you don't do that. Everybody gets arrested. They didn't have those kinds of public meetings. They had to do it secretly. Was it by having seeker-sensitive churches? No, that didn't happen either. Was it by having televangelists? Oh, they didn't have television. Or was it one-on-one, people sharing the message of life with friends? I think we have people that were talking with their friends about the Lord. Steve, you could probably tell some of what you've experienced there along that line in China.
Yeah, that's just, you know, with the oppression, this is the best way to meet so that they can't detect you. The safest way to keep people together. In fact, they would not invite someone to church on Sunday for the first time, because if they would come and that person would be a spy, they would report the church, get their money, the church would be closed down, and they'd have to do it all over again. So they would have them go to a Bible study or something like that until they could build some type of trust with them. And then they would invite them to the bigger part of that church. So this is this would all make sense in oppression. This is what happens today in places that are oppressive, because, you know, if you have in your house, who's to say you're not having a dinner with some friends over versus going to some facility and doing all that?
Now, in my article, I wrote with regard to the issues of that would divide these groups. And some of these people had Latin names. Some had Greek names. One had a Jewish name, but there were people with Greek names that were also Jewish. If a person were a free-born citizen, they would go by their Latin name, regardless of what their ethnicity was. So we have groups here within this where you have people with Latin names, and you're looking at people who have more money and they're free. And you're looking at people with Greek names who, in most of the cases, were freed former slaves. And then you have two places where in verse 10b, Greekos were of the household of Aristobulus, and then in verse 11b, Greekos who are of the household of Narcissus, who are in the Lord. Both of those, and by the way, it's a K in Greek, that's why I said Narcissus. They were slaves. So you're looking at people with Latin names that were born free, people with Greek names that were born slaves but have been freed, and then you're looking at people with Greek names that are still slaves. Then you had also Priscilla and Aquila, again, Latin names there. They owned their own house, but probably just about everybody else, everyone with Greek names, is meeting in one of these tenement churches. And you can imagine Paul saying there are groups that are all Jewish, groups that are Latin, group that are free slave, group that are still slaves. Oh, look at what happened here in Corinth. Everyone's against each other. And he's saying Rome could repeat the same thing. And so what is he urging them? Walk by the Spirit so that they can have the unity they're supposed to have, instead of looking, oh, you're Latin, I don't like you, you're Greek, I don't like you, and having all this animosity. Paul is looking at the big issue and he's saying, I don't want Corinth to repeat itself where everybody is against each other and it's all divided. Do you ever imagine that that's what we'd be talking about for the background on the book of Romans? You know, we look at Romans and we're not thinking tension ready to explode, and we're not thinking of big lots of different groups that are divided, separated, but being led by people that Paul had ministered with. Paul is giving them advanced lessons. It's not a book of the basics. Gospel of John is where you've got the gospel for the unbeliever. Romans is not that. Romans is an advanced lesson to make it so that Corinth is not repeated in Rome. Paul wants the message to go out from Rome. He doesn't want them to come fighting against each other, hurting the message, and keeping it from going out.
John, it shows, when you look at that 5% growth rate in the church in Rome, it shows you what a one-on-one interpersonal, a believer loving his neighbor, can do to grow the church.
Absolutely. Yeah, we tend to think we'll have a Billy Graham do it for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
What we think about how it's supposed to be done now is so. Paul would say, what are you doing? That's just not how they were thinking in the first century. When you look closely at the New Testament, it becomes evident people were talking with each other. And that's how people were attracted to the message. That's how they heard the message. Because when Christianity was under persecution, you couldn't have these mass meetings that we think of as being, oh, that's the way it's done.
Well, think when you go to church today, most churches, you can't ask the pastor any questions.
Yep.
He's too busy. I mean, he's greeting a few people. We can't have an hour of questions like we have right here and ask you. You don't get that dialogue.
Sure.
And feedback where someone can ask these things, so these people become more confident in their faith because they've studied through this stuff and talked about it in these small groups, these house settings.
So I see the background for the book of Romans, this here from chapter 16, gives us a lot of context that makes it easier to understand how the book flows. And that's so it's, I like to start with chapter 16 to give an understanding of the book as a whole. Because it's been viewed as if it were a tiny, tiny church that had no apostolic background. And they were just kind of making do, and Paul saying, I don't think all of you are believers, and so I'm going to tell you how to get saved. And the fact that the people that were the leaders in this these congregations were people that Paul had ministered to and with, it's a different perspective than if we look at these 20-some-odd people as the whole church. It's leadership within the church. Either sponsors that would say, okay, you can use my apartment, or ones who would actually teach. And it just sets up a whole different understanding.
So all these are pieces of the body.
Mm-hmm.
R, B.
Yep.
Whatever.
Steve's experiences in China certainly illustrate and reinforce this process.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, take us through how you think the church probably started right after Pentecost, when some people had come down from Rome.
Yep.
And heard the message, became believers there. Mm-hmm. They probably went back up and started that.
Right. And some of those people, over the course of time, became leaders. And as a result, troubles were brewing in the synagogues. See, you could meet in a synagogue because Rome regarded Judaism as a legal religion. So Christians were meeting in the synagogues and they were saying, well, you know, the Messiah has come. And you can imagine the controversy that they'd have in the synagogues. And there were huge numbers of Jews in Rome, in the city of Rome, and that's so Claudius didn't want them to have all the Jews fighting with each other. I mean, that wasn't going to be a good situation in Rome. So he said, get all those people that are worshiping Christus out of here. Those people that were regarded as leaders were kicked out. Paul met some of them, ministered to some of them and with some of them. Obviously, there would have been leaders that they didn't round up. Church would have kept on functioning. They would have tried to do so under the radar instead of meeting in synagogues. And eventually, Claudius, his edict is rescinded. Leaders return to Rome. Things keep on growing, but Paul's saying, oh, I want to get to Rome, but if I write a letter, that will help prepare the ground for when I'm there. Because he wanted for the message to go forth from Rome and not to stagnate. So,
kind of rabbit hole. Has the cause and purpose of Nero's fire ever been identified, or is there a consensus?
There's not a consensus, but most people think that Nero was somehow connected with it. He said that, I mean, he always had plans for a greater Rome, but he wasn't necessarily planning for the fire to get as big as it got if you were responsible for it directly.
So it wasn't necessarily a purge of Christians?
No. There's no evidence of that.
Okay.
Julie? 7:45.
I think you have time for questions.
So, questions.
So would you say the pattern of after the Jews, when they first started, the safe place was probably the synagogues, just like Paul went into the synagogues, they didn't want to listen to it, pushed them out, but there were some Gentiles there that said, hey, we'd like to listen to this message. And so the mixture started in Rome, same type of way.